We'll reconvene the House Revenue Committee and welcome State Treasurer Randall Edwards to us as our guest this morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think we'll turn it over to you. Paul, do you have any introductory remarks? Okay, Treasurer.
Great. Thank you, Committee. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this morning regarding an issue that I know you're well aware of and want to reemphasize some of the concerns and issues that we're having regarding just managing the cash position for the state. Let me say that the reason why I'm here this morning really is to tell you before you get into the special session the importance of, again, achieving a balanced budget in a timely manner, one, and two, how you achieve it is also germane to the issue I'm going to discuss about. As was handed out, I've given you a little bit of background about some of the cash challenges that are facing the state. We've got, as I sent out a letter last week, a week ago today, wanted to talk to you about the fact that while we have been running some cash balance deficits, which have been getting extremely large, in fact, unprecedented in their size and their duration, we are also facing two major school payments coming up in March, both in March and in May, March being $200 million and in May about another $600 million. So we're now looking at almost $1 billion, not quite, in payments that we've got to make at a time where our cash situation continues to fall. What we've been doing to date, and again, I've mentioned this both in a letter to you and here today, is that we've been managing this current cash shortfall by borrowing internally from a short-term fund, which we have, which has been a prudent way to manage the current cash situation. We've been doing this in the past. Previous situations where the state's run into cash imbalances, we've borrowed from this fund. But given the size and the magnitude and the duration of this cash imbalance today and in the future, we have limitations to how much we can continue to borrow internally. And you, during the last special session, gave me a new tool, which really is what we need to have to continue to manage our cash situation as we go forward, and particularly in light of this payment that we're looking at both in March and in May to schools. What I wanted to really emphasize here is the seriousness and sort of the timelines that we're working under. We are getting to a point where using the TAN to meet these payments is becoming a time crunch for me, for all of us to meet these obligations. And if you look at that flow chart, what we've spelled out here is sort of various scenarios of what might happen if we different budget scenarios and how you achieve a balanced budget and how that may or may not impact the state's finances. The first scenario, talking about a legislatively balanced budget, in my letter to you of a week ago, I underscored that we need to have a signed by you and the governor roughly the first week in March. And the reason for that timeline was, in essence, because in order for me to make a payment, particularly the May payment, in a timely fashion to issue these TANs, which again is a very prudent tool to use, and in light of the enormous amount of money that we do have to pay to meet our obligations to our schools, that is the shortest time frame in which I can go out and issue these in the marketplace. Let me underscore, we've never issued these in the past, so we've got to prep the market. We've got some startup time. We've been working on that. I also have to talk to all the bond rating agencies to tell them why we're doing this, the economic situation that you just heard. I've got to also package that and go down and talk to them, as well as, you know, how well is the state doing, not only on a broad base, but also financially with its cash situation. As I said to you before, getting a balanced budget is critical to my ability to issue these TANs so that we, in essence, move on and have an ability to meet our cash needs. What I want to really emphasize is what happens if you don't get a balanced budget in a timely fashion, and that is when you start looking at this chart and go down the various scenarios here. If you have a partial budget, and that's one where you may have, in essence, like today, you don't really have a balanced budget today since the governor vetoed it, so you're out of balance where you don't have a completed balanced signed budget. If you're contingent on a referral, you don't have a backstop.
Let me just ask about that if I can. So at the end of the special session, before the bills got to the governor's desk, even though we had the referral in place that included the $120 million transfer from the to-be-created Education Stability Fund, you would have regarded that on this table as non-contingent because it had a backstop piece to it.
The backstop wasn't the problem. I mean, that no, you had a balanced budget.
We had a balanced budget. So at the end of the special session, we would have been at that little box on this chart. Okay.
But you have to have it signed.
Well, I understand that. I'm saying when we did our work, yeah.
Right. And again, an incomplete budget could come in various forms. The point here is that the marketplace wants to see you have as close to zero as possible. I mean, a balanced budget, I mean, obviously the revenues you're forecasting, June will show another number. But they understand that variation. But your charge today is that you're out of balance and by a large amount of money. And you've got to come to an agreement on how you solve that. And so a partial or incomplete, let's just say you want to balance a certain part now and then you want to come back later, that's not a completed budget, and hence I can't issue the TANs. And I'll get to sort of the implications of that about a deficit note in a second. If you go to an allotment, that is, you don't balance a portion of it or we give the governor the ability to do the entire budget. Now, I don't, again, not saying that's going to happen, but it's a scenario that could happen. If it's, and that's under the allotment, if you allow the governor to have an allotment, you balance the budget, you can't come to agreement, he allots a portion or all of it, and it's unchallenged legally. And I, again, there's some question about whether that happens.
Any questions about whether that happens?
Well, I think, and then it's an issue of timing as well. So if it's unchallenged, we're not sure what that really means from an outsider's perspective. We've never seen an allotment done to the scale, which may or may not happen here. It raises some question. That's why you have a question mark whether or not we can issue the TANs. I can't sit here today and tell you I know exactly what would happen. If it's unchallenged.
Well,
obviously, if it's challenged, you're in a lottery bond situation. You don't have a balanced budget yet.
Let me just suggest you probably don't need to spend a lot of time wondering what would happen if it's unchallenged, but I think it's a certainty that it would be challenged because just the constitutional nature of the question that we would almost certainly get there.
I wanted to put down a scenario if it's unchallenged.
Yeah, I understand. I appreciate that.
My hope is if you were to do that, I mean, the timing of the challenge would also... If that didn't come until after we issued the TANs, I mean, that we could actually issue the TANs. But that isn't the ideal scenario, and as you're saying, the legal challenge is very likely. So that just raises an enormous challenge for us because we still can't issue these TANs because the marketplace will show an unfinished budget. You basically have no budget if it's legally challenged. It's limbo. And, of course, if you don't take any action, and, again, that's the last scenario, which is you don't do anything and you continue to go imbalance budget, I can't issue the TANs. So when you start going across the chart, looking at the different scenarios of how we might finance ourselves, if we can't get a balanced budget and if I can't issue TANs, then you've got some very dire consequences. And I really want to underscore, we're in uncharted territory here, period. Deficit notes are, and if you go to the second page, some issues about some of the ramifications to the marketplace. They're very rarely used, and you're sending a sign that the state's financial ship is in disarray. I would say today we would very likely see a credit downgrade of the state. Don't know for certain, but it's very, very probable that we would get a downgrade. And if you look here, we talk about all those implications. One is the bondholders of the state, those outstanding bonds that have been issued, those people who own them, they're now of lesser value. The Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act, which I've spoken to you before, which has been a great program to help school districts reduce their cost of borrowing, in essence, it would stop because we would see a less cost advantage for school districts, and they would most likely not use that program at all. And again, those bonds that are being issued by school districts and they're backed by the full faith and credit of the state would also see a devaluation of their valuations, same as the state bonds. All our interest rates would be affected on all the bonding programs that we have in the state. We laid out there housing, Department of Transportation, the OECD, that agency keeps getting new acronyms, but bond bank, the higher education COPs, the lottery bonds, all are affected by a higher interest rate. You just passed in your special session a ceiling to get hopefully more money out of your increased ODOT bonds. That $500 million would not be achieved. It'd seem considerably less than most likely than the $400 million. So then it would have some perceptional effects on local governments. While they issue their own bonds and they're freestanding, there is a thread of a relationship between how the state's finances are doing, obviously, and the local governments. Whether or not, in the end, they would see a change in their credit, can't say one way or the other, but there is a potential implication to their ability to access the market at the current rates that they're participating. I want to leave you with this on the deficit notes. We've never issued those, and this is an extremely serious sign that we have financial problems in the state. And it all comes back to the ability of you and the governor to come to an agreement on a budget. And the time is of the essence. And that's really the message I want to leave with you today, is that we are in uncharted territory, and the size of the cash imbalance that we're having today, clearly the deficit itself is enormous. It's an enormous challenge, both from a political point of view and a financial point of view. But there's many implications to, I need to have a balanced budget, but I also am concerned about how it's balanced. So an agreement soon is of the essence. And I'm running out of time and tools to meet, basically, our ability to pay our bills now and in the future. And the last, of course, is the worst of all, which is a warrant registration. And that's, in essence, saying we don't have money, we can't pay the bills, and we'll put out IOUs, and that's... That, in essence, you've had a complete meltdown in the state's finances.
Will this be comparable to junk bonds in the private market?
That's just saying we're not paying our bills, Mr. Chair. And
when we get around to it, we'll pay you, too.
Exactly. And the problem here is this, for sure, would show that we have a complete meltdown in our state's finances and our inability to pay our bills. It has immense ramifications. I mean, it's beyond just obviously setting up those IOUs. It would show to the outside market and the citizens of the state we are not meeting our obligations, period. And clearly we would get a downgrade.
Let me ask, I had a conversation with my son last night about how fast you can fall from an A to a B in math and how long it takes to get that grade back up to an A again once you've done that. And I guess I'd have the kind of the same question for you. Looking at any of the scenarios, deficit note or warrant registration, that would come from an unbalanced budget or the allotment or no action, and assuming that you're correct, that those would result in a downgrade of the state's credit, How long does that last? I mean, next session we're back in balance again, I assume. Does our rating just pop right back up again, or is it like my son's math grade? Does it take time to work your way back up to where we are?
Mr. Chair, you hit it. It takes time, and in fact, it's easier to go down than it is to come back up. You can look at other states. California's had a downgrade not too long. Well, when their Prop 13 passed, they got a downgrade. It took them years and years and years to get back out. And
over those years, you're paying those interest costs,
exactly.
Your bondholders
bonds
are earning less on their bonds.
And now you're paying more. And that, again, what we've been trying to do in this state, and I'd say we've got a very good bond rating, is to protect that and maintain it. So it has broader implications, and I think the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act, again, puts another constituency that's directly tied to this that wasn't there in the past. Great program, but it has broad implications, and it takes a long time to get back out. You know, what I'm saying, it isn't the longer-term problem for us would be it takes time to get us in a situation where we could actually get back to an upgrade, one. The cash situation has gotten to a point where we are really having our backs against the wall, and we were... appreciative of getting the TAN legislation, because we really need that tool, and that's the way we're going to get ourselves out of this. But the other shoe that has to drop is a balanced budget that's signed and sealed, and market says great, and then they're done. See, their problem is you don't have a balanced budget. They have no guarantee that they'll get paid, and that's the problem. Therein lies you're out of running deficits and can't run deficits, and they want to see us have a balanced budget before we can ask them for the money.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. I had always heard that the bond markets penalized states that didn't have a reserve fund, and assuming we avoid a meltdown and a government shutdown, what happens if we do actually create this reserve fund to Oregon's bond rating?
The one that was just passed in the special session?
Referred,
First, I personally really appreciate and applaud you for that work, because in the end, that is something that the state has needed for a long time, and any of us in this room have been arguing that we've needed that, and you found a way to create it. Not only created it, you had it funded, so you kind of got both at the same time. It's a positive. This would wait. That would not stop any downgrade, given the magnitude of our cash imbalance.
Well, I know, but assuming,
it would, as far as maybe climbing out, maybe it helps some, but it would be looked at. It would take years for us to climb back out of this thing. But that's I'm going to just leave it. I do believe that was a very positive step, and when I go talk to the rating agencies, that will be one of the things I'll talk about that we have done. I mean, that again keeps going forward, that we have. We've created one.
Well, I guess the other way to ask that question would be to achieve a legislatively balanced budget and have created a stability fund, rather than looking at this precipice. We've actually enhanced our status in the credit market.
We will have, and you will all have 6.0s for that.
Mr. Secretary, the Oregon Short-Term Fund, what's the size of that? How many dollars are in there? And where do those dollars come from?
Representative Brown, the Short-Term Fund is a short-term cash pool that's used by a variety of entities. I mean, and I'm a fiduciary to this fund, and it's basically a money market-rated fund. Local governments put money in it. School districts put money in it. The state has the general fund money, PERS has money, the state has money. It's a cash fund is, in essence, what it is, so that entities have their ability to pay bills. What we've done is some analysis on a cap to how much we could actually continue to borrow from it. We have decided and have done some analysis looking both legally what our constraints are and what's financially prudent. It's about $750 million to borrow against that, and we're very close to hitting that. So in order for us to continue forward to meet these new obligations, I need to issue these PANs, and can't right now.
Questions?
I guess I just wanted to make sure I understood exactly what the Treasurer was telling us. Had the Governor signed the legislatively approved budget that was referred to him in the special session, we wouldn't be in the situation you're suggesting now. Is that right? That would have been a balanced budget. You could have issued the PANs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, that's right.
Okay.
One other question I would have, and I'll ask it, assuming that you probably can't answer, but maybe you can give us a range. Looking at these consequences of the deficit note and going on into warrant registration, can you even begin to quantify what the costs, the aggregate costs over time would be from the downgrade of our rating to the time that we, get to that rosy day out there where we're back up again? I mean, are we talking tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars over the time?
I don't know what the exact, I mean, that would be hard to speculate. It would cost us tens of millions of dollars easily, and maybe hundreds of millions of dollars over time.
I think your staff is shaking at the hundreds of millions.
I don't have the rear view. Millions of dollars? Okay. I mean, we're going to continue to issue bonds. I mean, it wouldn't be a question of that. It'd just be we'd get less bang out of the buck for that. And then again, which has a cost to the state's economy, which is something we continue to try to help with these bonds, and it has particularly the cash issue. If we were to get out to a warrant, that would have. I don't know what the downgrade would be, but it would probably be pretty serious. be greater probably than one step, in which case you're issuing some very low-grade bonds, which we've never done. You probably wouldn't do it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, what you've been doing.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Treasurer, to get a little bit away from that doom and gloom outlook, we have routinely borrowed from internal funds on an ongoing basis. So that's not an unusual event.
No.
Am I correct?
And in fact, may I interrupt? And that is what we're doing today is not being viewed abnormally by anybody on the outside. I mean, it's common to do this. We've done it in the past, so that's not an issue.
And as I recall, one of the major points for wanting to have in your toolbox hands was just an ability to choose among instruments and to go to an instrument that whichever instrument has the most favorable interest rate at the time. So although we're speculating about an inability to come to some kind of budget reconciliation between the legislature and the governor, I'd like to get us back focused on that borrowing from internal funds is not at all unusual. In fact, it's been business as usual for decades in Oregon. And using TANs is not at all an unusual practice for other states to manage their cash flow. So we have the opportunity to operate very responsibly and have choices for you so that you can squeeze out the best interest rate deal you can find.
With a legislatively balanced budget.
Right, and I appreciate that comment. TANs, if we were to issue TANs, again, the marketplace, I mean, I've got to tell them a story why we're doing it and how we're doing it. We've got a balanced budget and we're being responsible. That, and as your point, you pointed out, which is, again, well noted, it's not abnormal. So that would be accepted. What the difference is, I guess, and I'm not saying you didn't say this, but where we're in a situation now, while there's an interest benefit to issuing TANs than the currently borrowing, the problem we're running into is, again, you got another number from there is a relationship between projected revenues and our cash needs. I mean, we are continuing to see our cash continue to get deeper and deeper below negative and maintain below. In the past, when we were awash in money, if you will, we would go down below cash balances, we'd pop back up. We're now under that line, and we've maintained under that line for quite some time, and that's the difference. So what we're running into in the past, we would assume we'd have a short-term duration, we'd be borrowing, we'd get out of it. Not short-term anymore. Now we're into this in months, and the magnitude, and there's a limitation. So that's why the TAN is a critical piece for us to move forward.
I might have a quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you. And just to make sure I understand it and the committee understands it, the issue with a balanced budget from the market's point of view is a demonstration of ability and, from my days as a banker, management's willingness to pay its debt. And that, from a market point of view, is a balancing of both how much we spend and how much we are prepared to raise whatever revenues are required to meet our spending, so that it is both a matter of the expenditure side of the budget and the revenue, and the term balance is the market signal that they want to see us keep those synchronized, so that if we're spending lots and providing lots of services, we pay for them. And if we're not willing to pay for them, then we have to cut the service level.
Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, the bottom line is the market doesn't care how you balance your budget. The market just wants your budget balanced.
Yes, partially. I mean, I guess that's the point I'm saying here about allotment. There is a qualification.
I'm thinking of the
list. Not at all costs. Let's just say that way. The governor would allot the, what is it, $863 million now? I don't think that'd be, I'd be pretty confident that markets wouldn't like that. It just, it's too big of a change.
And I'm sorry, I mean, legislatively, if you do it through the legislative process and it's balanced and it's signed, they're not so concerned about whether it's revenues or cuts or what revenues you use to get there. They just want to see a balanced budget.
Yeah.
Other questions? I have one. Has the governor seen this sheet?
Just about the time you're getting it.
Okay.
We talked to him yesterday about this issue.
You know, for the longest time in the building, the discussion has been, I think, over the constitutional question, can the governor use the allotment process? I think information like this changes the focus of the question entirely to should the governor use the allotment process, even if he can use the allotment process, given the long-term, both the immediate and long-term consequences of going to that strategy. It's shocking.
Interesting, Mr. Chair. I was looking at a website that's National Treasurers, and all the states are listed, and they just pull out clips about what's going on in other states. And let me just first say we're not unique in trying to wrestle with this issue of balancing a budget, nor are we unique about the issue of allotment in that authority. New Mexico's governor is going down, moving forward and managing the budget himself, or saying he's going to. The same issues that you're raising about the constitutionality are being raised there. So, again, we all have, again, the country is going through immense changes with their economies. And I just talked to somebody in Washington State. Their budget, they too just got new numbers, and their deficit's about $1.7 billion. California just got another $5 billion added to their hole. So, the trend, we're all in the same boats. And again, challenge for all of us, and particularly for you and the governor, is to come to an agreement about how best to do that. And okay, sorry.
All right. Questions? Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
Kate, did you want to come up and say anything into the microphone?
Oh, thank you.
Okay. All right. I want to thank you. That is, like I say, shocking, but badly needed information for us to have as we face the start of a second round on Monday. So thank you.
We're always around, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
The committee, any questions answered, anything else?
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Paul, what are we ready for next?
Mr. Chair, the next thing on our agenda is a discussion of housing fund reserves. And we had this as one of our interim issues to look at. Had intended really to spend a little bit more time than we have now, but we've asked the Housing and Community Service Department to come over and give us some background on the issue, what their reserve fund situation is. We've had a number of questions about it, so this is really to give you some background and address some of the issues that you may have heard in your caucuses and so forth.
Okay. Does it make you nervous coming up after that testimony to talk about the reserves?
Chair Shetterly, Co-Chair Walker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jack Kenney. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And first off, I want to say I do appreciate you putting us on the agenda. The issue of our reserves did get a lot of attention during the regular session, and we believe that this would be an excellent forum to discuss the issue. It's very complex without the pressure of having to fund important programs and get a budget balanced by July that we dealt with during the session. So as Paul mentioned, I have about 20 minutes, and that's probably 10 minutes more than anybody wants to hear about reserves, but it is a complex issue. So my plan is
Chair,
to...
Yeah. I guess, I'm sorry. Is your time up? You've heard enough?
Well, no. He was talking about the pressures of trying to balance the budget in July. Now it's March, and we've got an $800 million gap, and I just thought your timing maybe was a little better in July.
We don't have until July. We have until Monday.
Well, I still appreciate the opportunity.
Back to the script.
Well, thank you. I am going to give a high-level overview, give a little bit of context to our reserves discussion. Hopefully, you will have more time in the future to explore this issue further, and it would be my desire that you have third-party independent subject matter experts to talk about it. Clearly, I will give you the best information that we have, but these issues are subject to judgment in some cases, and as the treasurer before me noted, it's really, a lot of this is dependent upon what the external community believes, what the investment community and the basically the securities markets, how they would view such a decision. So in addition to the public policy implications for providing affordable housing in Oregon. So,
Jack, before you, just one other comment before you start, for members and for those present, to set this in context, I mean, this is an interim revenue committee meeting. It's not a special session meeting. We've been talking about issues that are pertinent to the special session so far in the morning, and I don't want to give the impression either to members or anybody else that this is here because there's a special session coming up on Monday. This was part of our interim agenda, and we're picking up on some of those things today. So I hope that maybe relieves a little bit of pressure off of you and why you're here talking about that today. I knew you knew that, but I want to make sure that everybody else understands that. This is not a special session issue.
Thank you, Chair. Certainly, I appreciate that. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about terminology. Just, I'll get to it really quickly. Reserves is the issue that it's kind of a shorthand for a larger range of issues. So there are something called legal reserves. I'm going through my handout right now. And those reserves are reserves in the truest sense. Anytime we sell bonds, there's an agreement in the indenture. People told me that I need to be more Reagan-esque in my presentation, so I did bring a prop. This is an indenture. It's basically, an indenture is it's a, like a legal contract. It's an agreement between trustees, bond purchasers, and the state of Oregon. The bond purchasers have a trustee so that they know that they will be protected. The trustee serves as a trustee, a third party that will make sure that both sides do what they say they're going to do. During the session, in our Ways and Means Committee, they asked, well, what are some of the legal restrictions? And it was a good exercise for us to go through. I had my bond manager go through, and we had 3 pages, single space typed, of just issues that were in, and this is just one indenture, we have 5 of them, where our funds are restricted under certain circumstances. So reserves is one level of restriction, and that's usually right off the top. And reserves in its truest sense are just where you take money and you set it aside. But there's other indenture restrictions that protect bondholders. For example, if we don't have assets exceeding liabilities by a particular percentage, usually it's 102%, you can't take money out of the indentures. So that was another issue that we discussed, is what is a reserve, what's legally restricted, and what's contractually restricted that isn't a reserve. And there's also management and business objectives for keeping funds, less at risk and not loaned, if you will. And we'll talk about those a little bit later. But clearly, from a from managing a loan portfolio and an issuer of bonds, there are other reasons for holding funds aside, and bond ratings is one of the primary reasons. Another reason is that much of our loan portfolio is uninsured. That's a practice that the state has used since the inception of our multi-unit bond program back when the program started in the probably 70s. One other issue to address is there's federal and tax law considerations. Typically, those go to compliance issues that we need to deal with on an ongoing basis. Once we issue the bonds, we have requirements that we must fulfill for a 15 to 30-year period, and we need earnings from reserves, typically earnings from investments, to fund those programs. Those are obligations that we've committed to for 30 years, and so we do need to have an ongoing cash flow to cover that. And, you know, the level that we do it is another management decision. I'm proud to sit in front of the Ways and Means when an issue is brought up about a property, an affordable housing property in some legislator's district. If there's a complaint about it, it's invariably not one of our assets. And the reason that we do that is we invest money in asset and property management. We go out in your communities and make sure that they're not letting the sidings fall off or the roof cave in or the high levels of crime necessarily being having. We go out annually and monitor these projects, and we have taken landlords to court for this. Sometimes we're challenged, saying, well, wait a minute, HUD's requirements aren't that we keep it up to this level. Well, ours are a little bit higher. That costs a little bit of money, though, and it's funded from reserves. So those are other management decisions that we make. Finally, I'd like to just briefly touch on controls on our department's activities. We're not a bunch of cowboys out there with $1 billion in assets and spending it. There's statutory and constitutional restrictions on how much debt we can issue. Then biennially, the legislature controls how much debt we can issue. Last session, it was in House Bill 2276. It puts limits on how much we can do. The treasurer approves every bond sale we do. And, of course, the legislature approves our both administrative and program budget. So we're not going to get crazy with money. You all have a say in how much money we can spend and where we can spend it. And that's, I guess I just wanted to make that point, because it is a lot of money, and your role is extremely important in monitoring that. Okay, the next thing is number three in the agenda is big numbers and less big numbers, and I will... I made a non-accountant's balance sheet. It's the second page or the back side of my outline in the handout. I kind of took a stab. I remember Stephen Hawking's book where he said if you put numbers in, you lose half your readership. And so I'm taking that risk. And
it's okay. We're the revenue committee.
Basically, what I mean by big numbers and less big numbers is that obviously we have a lot of money, and that is viewed every year or every biennium when we go to the legislature. If you look at the balance sheet, you can see we have cash and investments at June 30, 2001 of $587 million. Loans receivable of $1.021 billion. We also owe $470 million in bonds and interest outstanding, and we owe and there's other liabilities, but this kind of, I have the actual balance sheet on the last page, but this kind of simplifies it and gives you the big picture context. What that comes down to, bottom line, if you will, total fund equity, kind of retained earnings from a private sector standpoint, is $153 million. That's another number that I've had thrown at me several times. Well, you have $153 million in retained earnings. You know, what's going on here? What's the problem with us looking at your reserves and maybe wanting some of them? It's a valid point. I'm going to talk about it a little bit further, but I just want to say right off that $153 million is fund equity. It's just assets minus liabilities. You can't spend fund equity. Part of the difference there is computer servers, office equipment. You can't spend those. Accountants make us, and I am one, so defer costs. I mean, if we pay $200,000, $250,000 to issue bonds with lawyers and financial advisors and whatever, I mean, it's a very complicated process. We have to spread those costs over 30 years. We can't just expense them all right away. So some of those other assets that are included in the $27 million, That's money we've already spent, but we're just amortizing. So you can't spend that either. Another thing is our loan portfolio. If we were a bank and we're just shutting down, our loan portfolio is not typical of a bank's loan portfolio. We have a large percent of our loans are to group homes for mentally handicapped and developmentally disabled. When they started downsizing Fairview, our department stepped up in the 80s and did a lot of funding of those group homes. Those aren't loans that you could easily package and sell to a bank. They're not probably, or at least if we did, it would be at a fairly large discount. Similarly, we have a fair number of our portfolio in the assisted living facilities market, which is under severe stress right now, that market segment is. So it's not like we have, I mean, we are a lender for affordable housing. We lend to people for low income, and therefore it's not your prime real estate portfolio that you might find in a bank. We certainly have strong loans. Like I said, we take great steps to ensure that our assets, our properties, and our portfolio are well maintained, but it isn't a typical loan portfolio that you could just turn around and package. So, however, having said that, next point on my outline is, as a point of reference, fund balance or retained earnings, it is at least a point of reference. It's something to go by. And the way that typically housing finance agency is reviewed or compared or how strong they are, they take your fund equity and divide it by your outstanding debt, your outstanding debt for bonds typically. And by that measure, and that's the next page, is the 1999 HFA rankings. 99 is the most recent one available. I did call Moody's and had that confirmed that this is the last time that they've done this. But at that time, Oregon ranked 37th in its relative strength, if you will, as using retained earnings as a percentage of outstanding debt. This is a way to kind of equalize the Oregons with the New Yorks and the Californias, because obviously they have much larger balance sheets, but what relative risk are they taking? So by that measure, we are 37th at that point in time, and the median was 12.4%. We were 9.6. We're about 10.3% now. But in talking about this, it does beg the question, when you look at the bottom of the chart, how does somebody like North Dakota or Washington survive at 2.8 or 3.6? This, of course, is not a pure apples-to-apples comparison. Different state housing finance agencies operate in different ways. States that are at the bottom of that list typically don't have a loan portfolio that they manage like we do. They go out and get a credit enhancer like Fannie Mae, somebody like that, and they basically don't take a risk. They have someone else take all the risk, and they as a result, they get less profitability. They also get less say if you're not taking the risk. In our case, we typically try to drive them to serving the most at-risk needy populations. If we're holding the note, we have the opportunity to do that. If somebody says, I'm not taking any risk on this deal, I'll go ahead and issue bonds, and I guess probably should have started with that a little bit. I mean, the whole game, to step a couple steps back, is the federal government allows, that's another control on us, the federal government allows states a certain amount of tax-exempt bonds. You can't just issue an unlimited amount of tax-exempt bonds if there's a private sector partner involved, which typically there is with housing bonds. It's a per capita limit, and it can be used. And the per capita limit is not only for housing, but economic development, and I think energy. There's probably one other use for private activity bond authority. So there's a limited amount. So these states, like probably North Dakota and Washington, the ones at the bottom of the list, they take their federal authority and they basically loan it to an organization, a developer who wants to get a below market interest rate. In exchange for that low market interest rate, they have to agree to serve a portion of low-income tenants. So these states, rather than take the risk that Oregon does and many, many states do of taking the loan and putting it in a portfolio and monitoring it for 30 years, they just basically say, look, we will let you take the risk. If the property tanks and you can't pay bondholders, it's up to Fannie Mae or somebody to make them whole. So that way they need much lower amounts of reserves. And that gets back to the management decision that we've made. We have a loan portfolio that we manage. As I said, there are strict technical reserves. At the time the bond is sold, we have to put aside a certain amount. But that amount is not likely adequate to protect taxpayers in Oregon or bondholders in Oregon in the event of a severe economic downturn. So we set aside a little, some more than the minimum, and that's kind of the issue that it'd be good for a third party to kind of talk to you about. I mean, we make our decisions based on our analysis of the risk, and I think that's an issue that it would be good to hear from other parties on. These other states have almost virtually no risk because they've, in a sense, passed that risk off to a third party. So, cash flows. I've got this rather busy-looking flow chart here. I won't spend a lot of time with it on it unless you want me to, and I'll look for questions later. One thing, I do want to talk about the four top arrows a little bit, and they are larger arrows than the other ones for a purpose. And to step back, I've got the arrows all going into the Housing Finance Fund. We also have an Elderly and Disabled Program, which is a separate fund, but for illustration purposes, one will do here. I'll just quickly run through how our program operates. And reserves are a component within this Housing Finance Fund, but not the only component, or the strict legal reserves are a component of it. Basically what we do, how we run our business, how we make money, and how we develop affordable housing is we go out in the market with that federal authority that I talked about to get below market rate, tax-exempt bonds, low market rate loans, which we have to use for below market rate loans. We go out and we sell bonds. Maybe we sell $30 million worth of bonds. We borrow that money. People pay us $30 million. We put some of it in reserves, in the technical legal reserves, and we loan the balance of it out to people who agree to do low-income housing. And that's the next arrow over. The mortgage holders and developers of affordable housing, they take this, and we're limited by the IRS into how much we can charge. If we issue bonds for 6%, the most we can loan it out at is like a point and a half over. I'm oversimplifying. There's tax laws involved. But generally speaking, if we borrow money at 6%, we can only loan it out at 7.5% by federal law. So we loan the money out. And then the next big arrow, the third big arrow over from the top, is mortgage holders are paying us back. They're paying us back our 7.5%. We're using that money to pay back the bonds at 6%, and the point and a half that we make on top, we pay for the people who monitor the projects, we pay for our computer people, we pay for me, whatever. And then we also, if you will, put some of that away because it's uninsured, because these loans that are out there are uninsured. And then we repay obviously the most important piece is the fourth arrow over, we repay the bond purchasers with those funds. That's the people paying us the mortgages is what we use to repay the bondholders. Now, there's other things that are involved, the arbitrage rebates. We can only earn a certain amount. We have kind of a ceiling on what we can earn, but no floor. We can earn like an eighth of a point over our borrowing costs on investments. So anything beyond that, we have to rebate to the federal government. That was on my large balance sheet. You saw, I think, a liability of $7-8 million to the federal government. And that was something that was a loophole closed years and years ago by the federal government. A lot of states and municipalities were funding operations based on federal tax-exempt authority, and the feds put a stop to that. So now if you earn anything over an eighth, boom, take it back to the feds. Now, please stop me anytime. As this process goes forward, what can happen in an economic downturn, and this is why reserves are so important, is that third arrow over, those loan repayments, that bigger arrow might get smaller if people stop, if the property goes belly up and they're unable to make their mortgage payments to us, all of a sudden we have less money flowing into the housing finance fund. But the bond purchasers aren't going to say, oh, well, that's fine, your mortgagee didn't pay you, I guess you don't need to pay me. It doesn't work that way.
Let me ask, I guess, have you seen an increase in defaults or a decline in loan repayments coming in over the past
we have,
6 months, 8 months?
Actually, over the past year we have in our single family program, and my financial officer is here, but it was roughly, I mean, it was during the economic boom times, it was less than 1% is my recollection. And I believe now it's over 2% of mortgage holders in our single family program who aren't making their payments. Now, in our single family program, those are insured, so we won't lose principal event, but we do lose that cash flow stream that's used to pay off bondholders. In our multi-unit program, that's uninsured, so if those projects go down, we might have a $3 million loan that we have to sell at a fire sale, if you will, and then we're out principal to repay the bondholders.
Have you seen an increase in the default rate in those multi-family units?
Not at this time. We are seeing higher vacancy rates, which is a clear danger sign. We've also, I think there's been a well-publicized assisted living facility, national corporation that has gone into Chapter 11, and they have, I believe, 5 projects in our portfolio. Now, they're continuing to make their mortgage payments, but clearly the risk is heightened, and we are in communication with them regularly to make sure that things are on cue. Rick Krieger, my chief financial officer, just handed me this, that in fiscal year 2001, loan payment delinquencies rose from 2.5 to 3.96. So, and it was a little worse than I thought in our single-family program. So, again, the principal there is insured, but the ongoing interest or the ongoing repayment is lost. Okay.
Let me ask one other question, if I can. The 153 in retained, what you call retained earnings, the fund equity, is that the static number over the past few biennia? Has it been going up? Has it been going down? Does it vary? I just don't have any background on the fund.
Chair Shirley, members, that's a great question, and I think it has gone up in the word, let's say raw numbers, or, you know, as a percentage of fund balance, which, you know, as a percentage of outstanding debt, it has fluctuated, if you will. I mean, it's been as low as 8, it's been as high as 12, it's currently at 10.3. Mm-hmm. So I think due to inflation and just, you know, over time, it hasn't been.
Yes. At what point do you consider a person in default on these payments? Is it 30 days, 60 days? What's the number?
Chair Shirley, Representative Walker, I am going to see if I can get a help on that one.
Okay.
30.
30 days.
Bob Larson, my debt manager, thank you. 30 days. Sure.
Yes, Representative Fass.
I appreciate your Reagan-esque communicating skills, but I don't think the Gipper's going to be losing his legacy. Seriously, is there a standard ratio that you have for that event where the you know, there's an economic downturn and you want to have some cushion there? Is there like a 10%, 1% kind of a figure that you have, whether it's cash investments or some fund that you use? What is it?
Sure, Shirley, Representative Haas. If I understand your question correctly, we believe that for uninsured portfolios, that in today's market, 10% is a prudent level of overall reserves, including what's legally required, which typically is less than the 10% and beyond that. We base that on history from the 1980s recession, where we did have default rates that approached that in our single family program, and the nature of our loan portfolio.
If I could, yeah. Is that the $587 million? What fund are you talking about there? Is that the cash and cash equivalents, or is that the collateral fund?
Chair Shirley, Representative Haas, I should have mentioned that. I thought about that. I meant to say that you'll note that in the balance sheet there is no reserves, if you will, that shows. So that is an internal... we keep that internally as far as what our loan portfolio is, where our cash flows are. I mean, cash flows is really what a rating agencies look at, and that's really what it's based on. It kind of takes out some of the stuff, like I said, office equipment and things like that. So we take a look at the portfolio. We look at our reserves. So you won't see that on any of this any financial information that I've handed out today. It's kind of a moving target. That's one reason for the busy flow chart is that that number is very fluid, you know, as we have payments coming in and out. The $587 million, let me just speak to that, and I appreciate that Gipper has nothing to fear from me. When you look at the $587 million, I mean, I meant to talk about this too a little bit. A lot of that comes right off the top. When you look at $587 million cash investments at June 1st, we have debt service payments where we pay principal and interest in July 1 and August 1 for our single family and our multifamily programs. So when we do a balance sheet, it's almost unfortunate that in June, because we're getting money ready to pay bondholders in July and August. Then at any point in time, we've issued a number of bonds where people aren't ready for the loans yet. We've maybe made commitments on loans, but they haven't fulfilled all their obligations. So we've got money committed for loans to be made that's sitting in cash and investments, just waiting for them to get 90 days occupancy or whatever it is that we're comfortable with releasing the funds. And you take off that operating needs for a particular period of time. You've got to have some cash to pay the lights, et cetera, pay your legal bills, whatever, on an ongoing basis. And it gets down pretty quick to where that $587 million gets whittled down. And I will talk about this when we get talk about it now or talk about it later, but the number that we've kicked around is what's really unrestricted assets that we believe is necessary for prudent operations is about $19 million right now. But, I mean, tomorrow it could be 20, it could be 18. That's the fluid nature of this, as I was saying, is that there's always money coming in and out. The legally restricted reserves are set aside in account, and we're not going to do anything. We can't touch those by this. But the other parts that we keep for prudent management...
The prop.
Yeah. The other piece... money does flow in and out, so we have to monitor that on an ongoing basis, and that's more of an internal cash flow documents that are even larger than this problem. I didn't answer your question.
Well, I could, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I guess to cut to the chase a little bit here is, in the context of the special session, as you know, a lot of people are eyeing those reserves, and I know that there were a handful of legislators in the last session who spent months on this question. I don't mean to suggest you can distill it down in a 20-second explanation, but I was just wondering what that amount is and why it shouldn't be tampered with or rated, as the term sometimes.
Or is the question, you say you need 19 in those unrestricted, how much do you have now? Is that one way to get to the question? How much do you have now in unrestricted? That's not here on this non-accountant's balance sheet.
Okay. Chair Shetterly, Representative Hass, I think this is a perfect segue into the last thing I want to talk about, which is policy choices and ramifications. So
sure.
Might I try that? And if I don't get where you want me to go, take me there or, direct me. Because that's exactly what I did want to talk about is in the policy choices and ramifications is, basically how much, I get to boil it down to 20 seconds, as you said, is I guess the question, and I'll boil down the question is, how much money do you have and do you need it all? If not, can we have some?
Spoken just like the great community.
Thank you. I guess
if you make the answer as succinct as the question.
Probably not. But I'll give it a shot. I mean, really, there's some point where if the legislature took our reserves, they would be sued and lose, or not they, but the state. I mean, these documents are binding. And at some point, if you took something other than that, beyond that, bondholders would cry foul and the trustee would cry foul and they'd come and they'd say, put it back, and they would more than likely win. So the part that is, if you will, and I won't say it, and that totally your call, or the legislature's call and the governor's, is what I believe or my department believes is prudent beyond this, could you take that? And the answer is clearly yes. Is it a good idea? My answer would be no, but like I said, I think it'd be good to hear from other people who might have a different opinion or might not, but at least be independent and give you their take on it. Why I don't think it's a good idea? Walk through that. Am I going where you...
Yes.
Okay. But, first of all, I think my first point is to go back and reiterate what I've already talked about, is that compared to other state HFAs, our level of reserves is not excessive. We're 37th or 38th in the nation, or we were the last time they ranked it. No state HFA uses the minimum legal restrictions as the way they operate. It's just not a good idea. It's just not done. Have other state rated is, I don't mean to be, that's a term that Moody's uses. It's a technical term. Have other states redirected state HFA assets? Yes. And what have been the results? Well, it depends. And that's the difficulty with this discussion and the complexity is every situation is unique and the results are therefore unique. I can think of three cases where it has happened. If you look back on that chart, number one, as far as richest level of reserves, was Alaska Housing. And they have been rated. And let me talk about it. We are, and the state treasurer may have mentioned this, but right now Oregon is AA2. That is our rating. That's our GEO rating. It's also the housing department's Independent Revenue Program rating, AA2. Alaska, and I have to look at it, like I said, we're at 10.3%. Alaska's at 83.5. So if you took retained earnings as a percentage of outstanding debt, or no, Alaska's at 72. I thought they were one there, too. Alaska's at 72%. We're at 10%. Alaska's bond rating is AA2, the same as Oregon Housing. Now why is that? Because the state... redirected, I keep wanting to use the other R word, took some of their, and regularly goes to the well and takes funds from the housing reserves. They do. So what the ratings agencies have determined is, oh, your state has made a policy decision that the housing can be used for general program revenues. That's kind of the way you operate. And so your housing finance agency will be ranked the same as your state's rankings, AA2. So here we are in Oregon, AA2 with 10% reserves, and they've got 72% reserves, and they're AA2. What are the ramifications of that? The state treasurer talked about that. It all comes down to cost of borrowing. And in our case, for our programs, the cost of borrowing is basically passed on to low-income tenants or other, it reduces the amount of affordable housing that's going to have. I had a financial advisor do a scenario with a typical $3 million loan, 30-year loan, and I talked to some investment brokers. I said, look, what if we got downgraded from a double A to a single A? What would be the implications? And a guy from Smith Barney, I believe it was, told me 75 basis points likely. I said, well, that doesn't seem right. I see single A's that don't trade that much different from double A. He said, well, it's all a state-by-state thing. He said, if your state went from double A to single A, it would cost 75 basis points. I talked to some other people, and they said, yeah, that sounds about right. So using 75 basis points as a cost of a downgrade, as your interest cost change, on a $3 million loan for 30 years, the borrowing costs go up about $500,000 over the life of the loan, actually more than that.
Let me just add, I'm just curious, you raised a question. I know in the special session, we passed the bill that clarified the state's general fund liability to back lottery bonds. And I guess in the sense that if you were to make this redirection of funds and at the same time acknowledge general fund liability as a backstop for payment of housing bonds, wouldn't you then protect the bond ratings? At least if you maintain them as equivalent to the state ratings?
Sure, surely that would seem to be logical. If you're backing it with a full faith and credit, I know with our GO program, we're a double A, same as the state, and I guess eventually they'd have to assess a statewide property tax if we couldn't pay bondholders. Right. So I'm sure that keeps our rating secure.
Your comments just raised that question, so that's all that was.
Absent that, if our revenue program, I guess, exists on its own as it does now, an increase in borrowing cost of $500,000 to that affordable housing developer, what are they going to do? How are they going to pay for that? They're going to do one of two things. One is increase rents, which makes the project less affordable by definition if you've increased rents. So the low-income people are going to have to pay more out of their pocket to get a roof over their head. There's already a severe affordable housing crisis in Oregon. Probably don't have time to get to that today, but or they'll get that $500,000 somewhere else, which might be subsidies from the federal government that comes through our department in home HUD program grants or state housing trust fund grants. So we're basically increasing the subsidy which if you're increasing the subsidy per development, logically, you're going to do less developments because you're having to put another $500,000 more into each development than you do now to get the same population served. So the result of a downgrade is basically, and in some, you can't increase rents in some cases because the federal, you know, if you're doing federal tax exempt bonds, they put an upper limit on it based on area median income. So either you're taking the people that were below that ceiling and raising their rents, or you're throwing more subsidies into it. There's already a very limited pool of subsidies, therefore you're developing less affordable housing. So the effect of a short-term redirection of funds, if it results in a downgrade bond rating, is a long-term policy implication to providing both number of units of affordable housing and benefit of affordable housing to the Oregonians served. I had hoped that we could do this with more time and more time. So maybe we can later. I had asked some of the rating agencies people if they could be here. They couldn't on short notice like this. Ask them about, well, what is the number? Is there a magic number? And couple, three things came out of that conversation. One is, first off, the number is not the only thing. And I got a couple quotes from Moody's here. Generally speaking, a transfer or redirection of an HFA, which is Housing Finance Agency's reserves, serves to weaken its financial condition, and as such will typically have negative credit implications. So just the fact that it's done, and that's why I talk about taking unrestricted assets sets a precedent in Oregon. Our agency has been in existence 30 years. There's never been a redirection of our assets.
But again, that assumes you maintain them as separate programs entirely and you don't provide that backstop kind
right.
of liability.
Standard & Poor's had a similar comment. They said the importance placed on housing is a significant rating factor. So just how important affordable housing is in a state is important. And then security of an agency's fund balance and its management autonomy are essential in the ratings development. So both Standard & Poor's and Moody's talk about it's not just the numbers, it's kind of what you did. And that gets back to the Alaska example where their numbers are fabulous, yet they're AA2 because of the policy implications made by the state. Now, I said, well, I would imagine that these people are still going to press for a number. And the Moody's guy said, we would do cash flows under various, stress tests. He said, we would do cash flows under various stress tests based on where we think things were going, based on the economy, et cetera. And then we would see. But he said, I cannot give you that answer now. It's a fairly complex calculation, and he would need more information. So, no number. So, if that's where you're going, I don't have it. But, like I said, I think we're really not excessively reserved now, and I think given the economic conditions now, given our portfolio, I think we're prudently reserved. You see, I guess earnings provide responsible program management. I touched on that a little bit early already. I think our department, I won't say we're the Cadillac. I think I would be proud to look at just about any property in any one of your districts that's in our portfolio and say that it is a community builder. It's an asset. Certainly no blight on your community. But in some cases, and here's, I'm proud to say this, government has actually improved communities in some cases because of the care that we put into these. A lot of times they're low income, but they're not government low income. Government comes with some responsibility there, and I think we have upgraded many, many projects that, and projects is probably not a good word, but developments in communities throughout Oregon. So that costs money, though. So if we lose, if there's any amount taken out of reserves, one of the smaller arrows on my busy little pie chart was investment returns. And as we lose reserves, we lose the ability to earn money on that, even though it's somewhat limited by the federal government. We take that little bit and we reinvest it into operating a high top shelf program. Again, the taxpayers are on the hook eventually. I mean, the general fund idea is probably a good one, but in the current situation, if we're not able to pay bondholders in our elderly and disabled program, there's the taxpayers are on the hook. In our multi-unit program, there's a moral obligation implied. Our single family program, taxpayers would not be on the hook, but if we go into a default on bonds, then that's probably the end of our program. So I think that I do.
Your 20 minutes was up about 20 minutes ago, but it's good information. Any other questions? No, Jack, I appreciate it. It's very, very succinct.
Well, Mr. Chair, the message I think I got was if it may look tempting, whatever amount that might be there, but there is, from what I understand, there are some consequences, some ramifications that may, in the end, be more costly than taking what might look like an easy pot of money.
Mm-hmm. Shirley, Representative Hass, that would be my assessment of the situation, yes.
Although, again, I'm not advocating anything. It's as much intellectual curiosity as anything, whether that would necessarily be the case with an explicit general fund guarantee of those of the bonds within your program.
Surely, I would.
It seems to me there's a state commitment. You're talking about commitment, you know, being an issue. There's a statewide commitment by the state to the importance of housing because we're going to back those bonds with general fund revenues if we have to. The credit worthiness then ought to be equal to the state general credit worthiness, and it seems to me we may avoid some of those downsides And I don't, you know, there's a separate consideration what the policy implications are of that kind of a general fund guarantee and what kind of risk we're actually taking on there. But it's curious, anyway.
I would love to explore that with our attorneys.
Can you do it between now and Sunday?
Wait, pardon me? clearly, the investment earnings piece, it might require a larger general fund appropriation to our department to maintain the program at existing levels, because currently we do use those earnings.
Okay.
Thank you
very much.
I appreciate it.
Good to have you. Well, let's do the school revenue.
We have Steve and Nancy Heilig with us here.
Steve, just come up here.
I'd rather be out there.
Okay. Big shots at it.
Yeah. Nancy, welcome back to revenue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Nice to be here.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Steve Meyer, Legislative Revenue Office. What I want to deal with quickly this morning is look at or review with you changes in the local revenue forecast for schools and PSDs, and then just show you some numbers by district as to what happened from the change in those local revenue numbers and the changes from the special session. Start out with just a few comments about property taxes. Those are the major source of local revenue for school districts. And the overall change is $20 million for the buy-in in local revenue for school districts and ESDs. A decline of about $20
million. Decline, okay.
Not an increase.
He said 20, I was waiting. Everything.
The School Revenue Forecast Committee has met in December and January and did the revisions, basically, with a technical group as a part of a larger group that reviews the numbers. The good news, and I think maybe you've been told this before, was that the assessed value for 01-02 was actually a little bit higher than the forecast. That then gave us a higher base to work off of the forecast in 02-03. But in the review process, we reduced the growth rate expected in 02-03. So even though we were starting from a higher base because of the lowering of the percentage increase expected in that base, the 02-03 number is about $500 million less of assessed value than where we were at the end of the session. Now that $500 million isn't too much, and when you look at the tax build on that's not a large change either. Maybe $1 or $2 million decline in taxes and bill. The question that's important in this process is what's going to happen to collections on those bill taxes. That's where the major change is in the assumption. For 01-02, even with that change, we're not looking at too much of a decline, about $5 or $6 million out of that 20 be in 01-02. But the major portion then is going to be in 02-03, because we think the collections or payments on those taxes won't be as high as they have been in the past. We're assuming that collections will be about 97.5% or 96% of the amount of taxes billed. And that percentage includes what's paid for prior year's delinquent taxes. That's the total amount collected of current year, prior years, compared to taxes billed current year. Mm-hmm. Now, the value number seems pretty good because the property existed January 1 that those taxes are going to be built again. But again, it comes back to our taxpayers going to feel in November, this coming November, about paying their taxes and getting their 3% discount or being the second and third payments still in that same fiscal year, or will they choose not to pay part of them and be delinquent, at least partially, on their bill? So that's the unknown. It could be that those payments hold up and the $20 million appear. It would be much closer to where we were at end of session. Or it could be worse. But we think we're still in the ballpark as to what to expect for 0203. On the ESD collection side, it's all the same assumptions apply, but there it's only about $700 million a year for fall in local revenue. The other local revenue changes for school districts is that we expected the common school fund to be about $1 million lower than where we were at end of session. We expect the county school fund to be about $2 million lower. There's more risk in the county school fund number because more counties are becoming aware of the fact that they don't have to make a contribution to the county school fund. The county school fund is expected to be a lot higher this year because legislation changed the counties not having to pay some special education costs out of the county school fund. So the dollars went up to about $8 or $9 million. But now, if they choose not to pass that on back to schools, to the county school fund payment to school districts, then there's going to be a loss there. And we're currently assuming about $2 million. Multnomah County, for one, is, I think, contemplating reducing their contribution, the county contribution to the county school fund. So that there's more risk there in what that number should be. If you would then turn to the insert that you have, school formula revenue summary with local revenue update and first special session, just to show you the numbers there and how they compare to close of session. If you look at the middle columns, the local update, you'll see the changes there. I don't have the differences right beside the numbers, but you can see that in total, for the K-12, the local revenue is down $18.8 million. And for ESD is $1.4 million. If you go down to the allocation lines, you can see the changes then in the K-12 equalization formula line and the education service district line that reflects those same reductions in terms of what's available to K-12 and ESDs. If you look under the first special session line, you'll see that the resource numbers don't change, assuming that the voters pass HJR 50, and so that the $120 million is available to backfill the state school fund. But then you do have the changes from the local revenue. But you also have here on the allocation portion, the legislation that redirects $4.9 million from ESDs to K-12 school districts.
That was vetoed.
No.
Wasn't that part?
No, I didn't think so.
Really?
No. Okay. That was in the payment bill to go to.
Oh, that's right. That got stuck in that bill. I mean, yes.
that one was fine.
That's right.
So that's why when you look at school districts, you see that they have about an $18 million loss in resources, but it's only about $14 on the allocation side because they're getting money from ESDs. Just the opposite.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Steve. Of course, that and the reason that stuck in my mind was because that was intended to adjust the defunding, the suspension of the funding of the $112 million for the school improvement fund, and so that's been vetoed. That aspect. But the other piece that redirects the money is still in place. So we've essentially taken money out of ESDs. But we didn't get the piece that led us to make that adjustment. Isn't that right, Nancy?
Chair Shetterly, there is a provision in House Bill 4011 that directs the superintendent to notify the Legislative Revenue Office if the school improvement fund drops by at least $100 million, and then this shift would take place.
Okay, so it only, it's
only
triggered
if
to that.
There's
okay.
At least $100 million
okay.
drop in the
okay.
one.
Good.
It's conditional on
yeah.
in effect voter.
Okay. Good.
Okay, then at the bottom of the page under other state revenue, I note there the loss of the 112 that we had talked about. If you put the 112 and the 20 together, you get a total change of $132 million. That's about 1.8% of the biennial amount compared to where we were at close of session. Okay, the next page is just, excuse me, a normal cover page with the assumptions. And then following that is the standard printout for distribution by school district. This shows what we expect right now for 02-03 in terms of a first estimate, in terms of what, how the money would be distributed. Let me point out that these numbers will change real soon because the Department of Education has put out some more official numbers come early March. And so there'll be some changes in the base data and other numbers, depending on what happens this next week, that will be incorporated into those. So,
Steve, this is first special session, simulation 32.
I continued counting from end of session.
Okay. As I say,
I should clarify that.
Not already.
What I wanted to point out here is that under the school improvement fund, you shows, I show zero for 02-03. And then under the first special session columns, I show the I show the $4.9 million shift as an increase in formula dollars available, and then the negative $112 million for the loss of the school improvement fund dollars in the second year of the biennium. If you look at the, go back under the formula columns and look at the dollars for ADMW, you see a $5,073 in 01-02. If you add the $167 for school improvement, you're up to $5,240 per weighted student. And if you compare that to the 02-03 of $5,267 only from the formula, you're looking at roughly a $25 increase per weighted student still from one year to the next. Looking at the combination of local revenue, state school fund, and school improvement fund dollars per weighted student. Then the very last page of the handout provides similar information for ESDs. What is different here in terms of the ESD legislation was that ESD said that even though we're going to do this $4.9 million transfer to K-12, we want to go ahead and do our equalization calculation as though that $4.9 million were still there, and use that then to decide, determine how much our dollar allocation is on the equalization process, and then take the $4.9 million and subtract an equal dollar amount per weighted student from the equalization amount to get to our final distribution amount. So what you see there then for the change column is the loss of the $4.9 million, and that then is about $8 per weighted student for each weighted student in that ESD. The way they chose to handle that process. So that all of the loss would not be, as the equalization formula worked, all of the loss would otherwise have been to the low-funded ESD.
All right. Thank you,
Nancy. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman, Associate Superintendent, School Finance, for the Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about the status of the State School Fund. I wanted to talk about a couple of areas in the school fund. That there are really three factors that affect the level of funding that school districts are going to receive. And I'll talk about this from the perspective of the school districts. First, there's the amount of the state appropriation, which is, of course, is the major focus recently. The receipt of local revenues, which Steve has just discussed, and then statewide student enrollment. And although the student enrollment is really not technically a revenue issue, it is for school districts, because if the enrollment statewide increases more than expected, more than anticipated at the end of session, then the revenue per student will go down for school districts. And I did provide you a handout. If you go to the second page entitled Student Enrollment Projections, you'll see in the current biennium in both biennia, actually, the previous biennium and the current, that
the current projections for student enrollment statewide are substantially higher than end of session estimates. And if you look at the first two columns in the previous biennium, looking at end of session estimates at the end of the 99 legislative session, we had an increase of 7,387 students in 99-2000 and more than 12,000 students in the next year. In this current biennium, those numbers are approximately 3,600 for this year and 4,300 projected for next year. And that what that represents is a reduction in the amount per student that districts will receive, $27 for this current year and $43 projected for next year. We had projected the number of students correctly originally in the budget process, the school fund would have been $46 million higher than it currently is. So I think it's important to note that school districts are experiencing other reductions other through the school fund than just the state appropriation. Often, you know, there's some, we get a lot of questions about why are school districts having to cut so substantially when there's just a simple decrease in the school improvement fund. And it's because of some of these other factors that are compounding the problem for school districts. So just wanted to be sure that you're aware that this is also a factor that the districts are facing.
Okay. Questions for either Steve or Nancy? Appreciate that information. All right, then, committee. I think we'll take a lunch break until 1:15. Marge, we're going to have our team here at 1:15. Okay. At 1:15, we will take on urban renewal, so please don't eat a lot of carbohydrates for lunch. Although it's getting kind of interesting.
Only a lawyer would say
that. That was in the paper today, or was it yesterday, I guess? Yesterday, yeah. So we are a topical committee, if nothing else. With that, I think we will stand in recess until 1:15. Let's try to be sharp, and we can move the afternoon quickly along.